I'm just going to say this, and then we can talk about it, all right? Turning a corner, do you think? Maybe, sort of, kind of, because it feels like that, to me anyway. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, the 19th day of March. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. So let us test that premise, shall we? My vague sense that maybe, possibly, kind of, somehow, we hope, fingers crossed, we are on the mend economically. Gina Smilek is at the New York Times. Jordan Holman is at Bloomberg. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Gina, we're going to save the prognostication thing for the end of our little segment here. But I do feel like we have to spend some time on the Federal Reserve, Jay Powell, and inflation. Mr. Powell spent most of his press conference on Wednesday, I guess it was, trying to deflect or beat back questions about inflation, where the Federal Open Market Committee thinks it's going, how worried he is about it. He spent a lot of time saying, in essence, we're not worried about it, and if it happens, we got it. The bond market, on the other hand, in the form of rising yields on the 10-year Treasury note, said, yeah, no, I don't actually think that's right, Jay. We're a little worried. What is going on?
So I think that there is a real gap in timing here. So I think what we're seeing in the 10-year Treasury note is that investors are both becoming confident that we're going to see a little bit more inflation, but also becoming confident that we're going to see more growth. And so that's really what's moving that up. But when you look at inflation expectations in the market, they have moved up, but they've really moved up, you know, most sharply for the near term. And then they're a little bit less pronounced in the longer term. And I think that's what people like Chair Powell are talking about when they say that we're not so worried about inflation in the longer term. You know, there's a big difference from the Fed's perspective between a jump up in prices this year, which they broadly expect, and lasting inflation that becomes a problem down the road, which they do not expect at this point.
Jordan, let me ask you this, though. Is it possible, and we heard a lot of this, you know, back in the beginning of the pandemic and when the recession was actually at its worst, you know, you can talk yourself into a recession. Consumer expectations are a key thing. Can you talk yourself into consumers expecting inflation? Is that a thing, do you think?
Possibly. What you can talk yourself into is that consumers will want to spend at a certain time. So that's what a lot of retail chiefs are just hoping, that even though what we saw this week with retail sales is that they were down in the month of February, a lot of the speculation was that we just have bad weather across the U.S. and that it's more of a blip compared to what the reality is going forward. It's more so thinking that that surge that we saw in January will keep going, that consumers really will spend on that pent-up demand that everyone's kind of talking about in the retail world, and then that will help lift the economy.
Last thing on rates and yields, Gina, and then we'll move on. The thing about it is that money will get more expensive, right? And then that could have conceivably a dampening effect when everybody's so ready to spend and go and travel and just do, you know?
Right. And that absolutely is something that the Fed is paying attention to. And they've been very clear that if they see rates move up so much that A, they cause disorderly trading conditions in the Treasury market, so basically things get messy, or B, they actually, you know, move up high enough to actually weigh against the Fed's goals and keep the economy from recovering, then the Fed's going to do something about that. But for the near term, you know, as long as they kind of stay contained and sort of, you know, move up, but not irrationally. Right. I think what we're going to see is a steady and patient Fed that just kind of, you know, watches it, talks about it a little bit, but doesn't get too panicked.
I love the idea of Powell just sitting there going, yeah, you know, whatever, we'll see. Okay, anyway, sorry. So, Jordan, let us get to the retail chiefs. You've been doing a bunch of reporting on what retail CEOs are thinking once this, you know, trillion and a half, perhaps a little bit more of money that's on the sidelines gets going. How are they thinking about the aftertimes in terms of how they're going to handle that?
So when it comes to the timeline, the after times they expect is happening in the second half of 2021. So we're talking about the summertime, thinking that vaccinations will really be widespread. And a lot of the CEOs I'm speaking to operate the stores in the mall. So their idea is that this so-called revenge spending will take place. The idea is that
revenge spending?
Revenge spending. Yes, it's something we saw actually in China once that government started lifting some of the restrictions last spring.
Yeah.
This idea that people are tired of just, you know, shopping online, and they want to go back out into the mall and in like social gatherings, and they're going to spend all the money that they've been saving up. And so this kind of idea of, yeah, the revenge spending, you hear it from CEOs of TJX, which owns TJ Maxx and Marshalls, and some other retail chiefs have used this phrase. But the idea is like, we have to wait and see. That's still something that we don't know is going to occur, but it's something that stores like Macy's and Kohl's have forecasted for the second half, that sales would definitely be stronger later this year.
Wow, that's wild. Revenge spending. Okay, so on that, let's turn then to the prognostication, right? And Gina, last time we had you on, or maybe the time before, I don't actually remember, I said, so what's this economy going to look like 6 months? And you said to me, you know, I could go either way. I could see a scenario where it's going gangbusters and everybody's got their shots and we're good to go. Or something happens, the virus gets back out of control, and we crank back down. So let's get back to the opening of this program and me kind of winging it and saying we're turning a corner. What do you think?
I think we are turning a corner. I think that there is still a big risk in that if we get virus strains that we cannot control, that could obviously derail this whole thing. But I think the train is headed in the right direction at the moment. You know, the government has done a really aggressive job of making sure that it kept households and businesses whole through this period. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there is a good chance that we get to the other side of this and they can kind of just snap right back. And then, as Jordan was saying, you know, we've got consumers who have a lot of savings to spend. And so that makes the back half of 2021 look like a pretty positive story.
God, the back half of 2021 sounds like it's really far away, I got to tell you. Yeah, but that's just me sitting here in March. All right, Jordan, same question to you. What do you think? Corner turned or not so fast?
Yeah, I agree that the corner is turning, especially when you look at the stimulus payments, how they're significantly higher this round than the last. And when you think about the $600 last round, a lot of retail chiefs were saying, you know, that helped lift their sales. So now when you think about this higher checks or higher amount of money that's going into checks, it's more of a question of not if this will lift discretionary spending, but just how much. So that will definitely help us turn a corner in this economy.
And you know what's interesting, actually, just on the way out here, this is the first Friday in a very long time where we have not talked about some kind of relief bill being on the way. I mean, those checks went out on Wednesday and people have the money, you know, Gina, right?
Yeah, we're you know, we are through the relief planning stage and into the relief spending stage. Hopefully we're getting there.
Hopefully. Gina Smilek at the New York Times and Jordan Holman at Bloomberg. Thanks, you two. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Guy.
Thanks.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, you know, it was a little up, a little down. It's kind of Friday-ish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, the setup for this next story is about a company, but the story itself is really a whole lot bigger. The Walt Disney Company faces a new complaint in an ongoing lawsuit over gender pay discrimination. The claim is that the company enforces a strict pay secrecy policy. You can't talk about your salary. Disney denies it, says it's going to fight it in court. But like I said, this story is about more than just one company. It's about trying to close gender and racial pay gaps by making salaries more transparent. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
The rules about sharing salary details were made crystal clear at Amanda's last job at a communications company in Chicago. We're not using her last name because the stuff is sensitive and she worries talking will make her look bad.
They're like, you can't tell anybody. That's just the way it was. It was in the handbook. And I was like, okay, well, my boss tells me not to, so I'm not going to.
Until a couple years ago, when she started interviewing for other jobs.
It was like, not only am I underpaid, like I'm being paid entry level, you know, obviously not discussing it. Let them get away scot-free.
Which is exactly why advocates for pay equity have been fighting these policies, says Emily Martin with the National Women's Law Center.
One of the things about gender pay discrimination that is so insidious is that you can be a victim of it for years and years and have no idea.
Unless workers talk about their salaries, which they have a right to do under federal labor law. And yet, says Jake Rosenfeld, a sociologist at Washington University,
these workplace rules, kind of informal or formal, that bar or prohibit workers from discussing their pay are incredibly commonplace.
He found half of workers said their employer has such a policy. Companies get away with it because there's not much penalty for violating the law, and
because it accords with a kind of general salary taboo that many workers oftentimes don't need to be told, we don't discuss pay in this workplace.
But he says that taboo is weakening, especially among younger workers. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
So you remember yesterday, if you heard the show, and if not, first of all, why not? But also, by the way, podcast. Anyway, we told you yesterday about Amazon getting deeper into healthcare. Today, it's football. Amazon's going to pay about $1 billion a year to be the exclusive carrier of Thursday Night Football. For now, you can watch on Amazon or on Fox, but starting in 2023, you're going to have to pony up for Amazon Prime. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on the streaming desk today.
Thursday Night Football is not where the money is. At least, it hasn't been for broadcast networks. But Jim Nail, an analyst at Forrester Research, says for Amazon, that doesn't really matter.
Amazon is so enormous that $1 billion for them is not the same as $1 billion would have been for Fox or one of the other networks.
Even if the games themselves don't end up being profitable for a while, or ever, chances are having them only available on Amazon will get more people to sign up for Prime, says Dan Rayburn, an analyst at Frost & Sullivan.
The number one driver of content on the internet as far as length of time viewed and engagement is sports. So we believe that Amazon is paying the money they are for this to bring people to the platform, hoping that while they're on the platform, they're making money in other ways.
Through advertising and, of course, getting people to buy more stuff. David Niebuhr, a media economics professor at the University of Toronto, says Prime members tend to do that.
Typically, a Prime member spends $1,400 per year. A non-Prime member spends $600 per year.
So, Niebuhr says, spending $1 billion on NFL games is worth it to bring in more members.
If they know that e-commerce sales tick up just by 0.5%, then we're already talking about tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue.
And Niebuhr says, unlike with free shipping, which is already as free as it's going to get, there is still room for Amazon to up its game when it comes to streaming. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we play every single day, 7 days a week.
Practice makes perfect, no matter the paycheck. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go on a Friday. Dow Industrial's down 234.7%, closed at 32,627. The NASDAQ advanced 99.7%, finished at 13,215. The S&P 500 basically flat, 39.13. For the week, the Dow trimmed off 0.4%. The NASDAQ shed nearly 0.8%. S&P 500 dipped 0.7%. Told you recently about traffic jams at some of the big ports out there. Well, here you go. Nike said delayed shipments because of those port problems is affecting revenue. Shares down 3.9% today. Bonds didn't do much. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note ended at 1.72%. And you are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is going slower than we would like in a lot of places, yes, but vaccines are getting out there. Essential workers and medical staff, seniors, now increasingly people with other risk factors. Also, though, the people who grow and process the food that makes its way to our grocery store shelves. So, a couple of days ago, we got Patrick Smith back on the phone. He and his family run Loftus Ranches. Apples and hops is what they do up in Washington State's Yakima Valley. And I asked him when we talked how it's going.
So far, so good. You know, we're feeling pretty optimistic here, especially today. The state of Washington accelerated the timeline for vaccinations for agricultural workers. And so we've actually got most of our employees today at a clinic getting their first shot. So
that's great.
Feels really good to be in this spot right now.
Yeah, just a quick word here on your workforce, right? I mean, you deal with a mobile workforce, right? They come and they go, they move around. You obviously pay the expenses. I talked to you and your dad when I was up there a number of years ago. You put them up. But they're in, you know, sort of group housing, and it's close quarters, and vaccine and virus stuff is real for them on the ground.
Yeah, it's close quarters. They work together. They ride to work together. They cook dinner together. Yeah, those environments definitely do have a higher risk of transmission. And, you know, it accentuates the importance of getting those people vaccinated. They are on the front lines of the food production mm-hmm. industry in this country, and putting them at a high priority to get vaccinations, like State of Washington has done here, is welcomed, especially in areas like Yakima County, where such a high percentage of the population is involved in these types of activities that don't lend themselves to working from home.
Yeah. I don't want to get too deep into the politics of this, but obviously there's a change in the White House. There is some change in trade policy certainly being talked about. Is that a wash for you? Have you seen it? Are you paying attention to it?
Yeah, we're paying very close attention to it. You know, there's still some challenges to overcome around, you know, some of these shipping container shortages and just global supply chain and logistics issues that are impacting our ability to get some of our products overseas.
All right, wait, let me back you up to the shipping container thing, because we had a story on the program a number of days ago about shipping containers and the shortage of it. And I need you to help me understand how an apple farmer in the Yakima Valley is concerned about a global shortage of shipping containers. I guess your stuff goes in containers.
Yeah. So for the products that we ship over to Asia, going on ocean freight and in shipping containers is our primary method of getting that fruit over to large Asian markets, right? And so when we don't have the big metal boxes to put them in to get them on the boat, that fruit sits here in Washington waiting.
It's a global economy. We just work in it. Real quickly, can't talk to you without talking about hops, because you guys make beer too. I am, in point of fact, wearing my Bailbreaker Brewery t-shirt today, which I paid for, by the way, just for the record.
Wonderful.
How's the hops business? That's what's going in the ground, right? Hops now?
Yeah. We're getting fields prepped for planting for hops. The hops business is good, but, you know, sales that we thought we were going to have didn't come to fruition because people aren't drinking out in bars and restaurants. And so there is certainly an impact there, but we're getting through it.
So just real quick, and then I'll let you get back to the work of actually running your farm. How long do you figure it's going to be until you can look back and say, okay, we're through it and things are normal again? What's your guess?
Yeah, I'm really hopeful that when we get to our harvest season globally, things are really looking up. I'm pretty optimistic. Hopefully by kind of late summer, we've got most of the pain behind us.
Here's hoping. Patrick Smith, he and his family run Loftus Ranches and a brewery called Bailbreaker up in the Yakima Valley in Washington. Patrick, thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.
Yep. Thanks, Kai.
We're just a little bit less than 2 weeks out from opening day, April the 1st for Major League Baseball, supposed to be the first week of May for the minor leagues, but the calendar is far from the only difference between the two, the minors and the big leagues. Our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, is looking this season at work in this economy, how it's changing, and some of the challenges with it. And that gets us to the national pastime, lower divisions. Marketplace's Peter Ballinon Rosen has the story of the fight over minimum wage in minor league baseball.
I've always loved going to minor league baseball games. There's the game, hot dogs, fireworks. It's this whole spectacle.
Ready, set, throw!
But for minor league players, there's a dark side.
The amount that we do get paid is so small, it's truly baffling.
This is Anthony Hsu, number 31, a pitcher with the minor league Springfield Cardinals, a team in the St. Louis Cardinals farm system. When Anthony signed in 2016, it was a dream come true. And hard work. On a typical day with the rookie team, he'd have team warm-ups, pitching practice, batting practice, weight training ahead of the actual game.
We're usually there from 2 p.m.-ish to midnight-ish. Yeah.
So that's like a 10-hour workday, pretty much.
We play every single day, so it's going to be 7 days a week.
No weekends and no overtime. Anthony was shocked when he got his first paycheck.
I got $425. Is this missing a zero, maybe?
Anthony says that evened out to less than $4 an hour. Now, the MLB makes over $10 billion in revenue annually, and major league players make a minimum $570K a year. But players I spoke to said the minors felt alien from that. It was unpaid spring trainings where guys just get per diems for food. Then, during the season, bunking with multiple roommates to make rent. And skimping on things like an actual bed.
Four guys and I think a two-bedroom apartment, just sleeping on air mattresses.
That's Garrett Brushhouse. He spent 6 years as a minor league pitcher for the San Francisco Giants before becoming an attorney. In 2014, Garrett took the baseball industry head on. He filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of former minor league players, saying MLB and its teams, who employ minor league players, violate minimum wage and overtime laws by not paying players for off-season training and not paying overtime, despite players working 50 to 70 hours per week.
Just trying to apply your basic, you know, wage and hour laws, the same laws that Walmart and McDonald's comply with, to minor league baseball players.
In the years following the filing of the 2014 class action lawsuit, which still hasn't gone to trial because of appeals, the baseball industry went looking for help. The MLB, team owners, and minor league baseball bigwigs launched this coordinated effort to lobby Congress to rewrite federal law and carve minor league players out of minimum wage and overtime requirements.
Our main argument to Congress was, you need to pass this because it goes to our survival.
Stan Brand was one of the chief architects of the lobbying effort and served as vice president of minor league baseball for 29 years, a separate organization from MLB, but one that also lobbied to carve minor league players out from the law. Here's what made Stan really nervous. If players had to be paid more, they'd be more expensive. So to keep costs down, MLB might not supply players to as many teams, which could mean towns all over the country would no longer have affiliated baseball. If this is a business model that relies on employees who aren't subject to minimum wage and overtime laws, is this a good model?
Well, look, it was good from my perspective in that it fostered the survival of the magic of the community-centered minor league teams. So to that degree, it was a positive.
And in 2018, the change to law passed. But in spite of that, MLB recently declared that this season they were going to reshape minor league baseball, draft fewer players, and cut 40 teams.
To me, that's a betrayal of our going to Capitol Hill and seeking this amendment.
MLB declined to be in this story. Remaining players will now get a raise and make at least minimum wage during the season, but it's not a huge win. Still, no overtime, no pay during spring training, and many making annual wages far below the poverty level. I'm Peter Bellinon Rosen for Marketplace.
There is more of Peter's story, Tales of How the Law Lets Baseball Do What It Does, on our podcast, The Uncertain Hour. Check it out. This final note on the way out today, in which I get it, but I kind of don't get it. It's a letter from the producers of this year's Oscars to all the nominees, laying out the what's and the hows of this year's award show. And it includes, the letter does, which I saw, by the way, at Deadline.com. It says this line: "For those of you unable to attend because of scheduling or continued uneasiness about traveling, we want you to know there will not be an option to Zoom in for the show." They do say in the letter they're going to take all the same precautions as studios and movie sets do, but you could totally see some people not coming, right? Here is your moment of economic context, Friday edition. Maybe as schools start to think about spring break, summer vacations not far off, people really want to not be where they have been for the past year. 1,407,223 people went through TSA checkpoints yesterday getting on airplanes. It is the most all year. And it is, I'm telling you, the sound of a corner being turned. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, will you? This is APM.